making TV special.
Venice. Made with creamy butter.
And you know what that means?
It's happening. I can feel it.
Yep.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another special interview episode from MediaMonarchy.com. My name's James Evan Pilato. I'm your host and webmaster of the site and show Media Monarchy. And I'm coming to you late on a Sunday evening. It's July 19th, 2009 here in Portland, Oregon. But on the line, we're on the line with the west coast of Japan, I believe, with our good friend James Corbett of CorbettReport.com. Thanks for taking the time, brother.
It is a pleasure to be here, and it's a pleasure to be here on my maiden voyage on MediaMonarchy.com. It's good to be talking with you again.
This is great. Now, I have probably lost track of when you and I first started to get in touch, and we've definitely shared a lot of links. And one of the things I guess I'll put right out in front is one of the main things of the numerous things that I love about your show and your site is that on, you know, Sunday afternoons to me, I can set my watch to you are going to have a new episode up and it's all going to be up and it's all going to be ready, which being basically a, you know, an aggregator kind of blog, I count on the alternative media shows having a timely, dependable schedule with a blurb and the links and everything works. And I commend you on that because, again, you know, I think you and I both are pretty much alone on this. You, I believe, run Corbett Report entirely by yourself. Is that right?
That's correct. It's just me.
And Media Monarchy is just my baby. It's funny. There are some times where I've gotten you people at Media Monarchy. It makes me laugh. Nope, it's just me.
Yes. Well, I think you're right about that. People in the alternative media sometimes maybe don't take that into account, but it is important, I think, to have that regularity so that it does become part of someone's Sunday afternoon or whatever. It can become a part of someone's schedule. And that's something that the controlled corporate media is, of course, very good at, a uniform, regular, on-time delivered package. And that's something that I think if the alternative media took more seriously, I think they'd perhaps start to have more of an effect. But let me just say, we've talked about it in our correspondence, but let me just say it for the listeners out there that I'd like to commend you once again on MediaMonarchy.com and all of the incredible hard work that you put into it. And I'd just like to say once again that it is one of the very few podcasts that is an absolute must listen to for me. And I get lots of the stories for CorbettReport.com through MediaMonarchy.com. So my hat's off to you.
Thanks so much. I really appreciate that. And that means a lot. And that's been something amazing over the last several months, as I think our relationship has grown, as well as mine with Clyde Lewis here in Portland. It's amazing to me. And again, essentially my site, I just have tons and tons and tons of news and links, and you can kind of do the research for yourself. I've kind of laid out the path for you. And when I then hear those stories put into both your episodes as well as Clyde Lewis's, which are more thematic, and I hear those stories, which to me was just a crazy headline, you know, that I didn't have time to flesh it out on the page, but to hear it then get fleshed out in the larger context of whatever present topic you guys are discussing. So again, I think the harder we can work on this, the better it'll be for all involved, essentially.
Absolutely. It's a virtuous circle, and both sides are needed. We need a site like yours and a program like yours, which has just a phenomenal amount of data. And then we need the other types of sites that concentrate on the thematic fleshing out of those stories. And both are very vital. And together, I think it's an incredibly good symbiotic relationship.
Absolutely. I like that. Virtuous circle.
There you go. There you go. There's another title for another one of your great websites or bands or something.
Well, let's cut to the chase and get to the important topic at hand. And this was what I didn't know at the time was what you mentioned at the end of your last episode, is that you had a massive truth bomb you were about to drop. Now, I believe this is going to be the first show that you're going to talk about your new article, 9/11 and Cyber Terrorism. Did the real cyber 9/11 happen on 9/11? So the article has been picked up. I've seen it now blasting out from all around the world just through my feed reader. So I've seen it on everywhere from InfoWars to Global Research to Australian websites I've never heard of. So is this the maiden voyage for you to discuss the topic of your new article, 9/11 and Cyber Terrorism?
It is indeed, and I want to thank you for giving me the opportunity to discuss this, because I think this is a huge really important story, and in anything approaching a sane world, this would be the story that would be getting the kind of attention that the Michael Jackson story got. But of course, as you and I both know, it's not a sane world. And just to clarify, actually, this isn't the truth bomb that I mentioned at the end of episode 94 of the Corbett Report, but this is something I think that is of extreme importance, so I'm glad that you're helping me to get the word out about this.
Absolutely. And again, in our recent correspondence in setting up this talk, I've said numerous times on the show that 9/11 truth always seems to focus on the controlled demolitions, which I will be the first to admit, that's what got me into looking at 9/11 truth in 2002 and 3. But as the years have gone by, it seems as though the controlled demolitions is the big speculative spectacle that gets all the headlines and gets all the attention, and if the talking heads are going to have someone representing 9/11 truth in any way on their shows, 9 times out of 10, it's always going to be about the buildings. So my thoughts on this is that, of course, the building explosions are suspicious as hell, but unfortunately, all that stuff is gone. And I don't know that we're ever really going to get to the bottom of all that. So having said that, absolutely, the buildings are suspicious. For me, we need to go to some of the people and the businesses and the places and the transaction. And what's that famous maxim? Follow the money. So in an effort to not focus all the time on the quote-unquote controlled demolitions, give us just a brief thumbnail, and then we'll flesh it out further on your new article, 9/11 and Cyberterrorism.
Well, first, let me just say that I agree wholeheartedly with you about the demolitions and the way that the 9/11 truth movement has become, at least in the eyes of people outside of that that research community, it's become nothing but the demolitions. And I think it's important to widen the scope of the investigation in the general public's mind, because I fear something like what happens with the JFK assassination, where when you mention it, everyone will think about the magic bullet theory, or did he get shot from the side or the back? And it all becomes about the ballistics of the actual shots themselves, where when you actually start to look into things like, you know, Lee Harvey Oswald's incredible past and the various people he was tied to and all of the things about, you know, E. Howard Hunt's confession. And when you start to look at the other aspects of that, rather than just the physical evidence of what happened that day, the story starts to become that much more important and that much more contextualized. But moving into this article, the 9/11 cyber terrorism, I guess to contextualize this, I think right now, obviously, what you've been covering on MediaMonarchy.com recently is the expanding hysteria, media-fueled hysteria about the cyberspace war. And by the way, cyberspacewar.com, I'm looking forward to that. I hope you get it up soon. Now is the time for a site like that to aggregate this type of news, because there's no doubt they're moving towards that direction as we speak. We've seen so much happening in that general frame of reference over the last few months, from Senator Jay Rockefeller's new bill that will essentially allow the president the power through his cybersecurity czar to shut down the internet, which is what the Mother Jones article that appeared recently was about. And we've seen the setting up of the new cyber command under U.S. Stratcom to be headed by the chief of the NSA, of course. We see all this preparation getting set up for this gigantic cybersecurity infrastructure, which the New York Times has admitted is now a multi-billion dollar industry, and all of the largest defense contractors are racing to get their piece of that pie. So there's no doubt there's just this huge infrastructure being set up right now. And of course, as with everything else, if they set up this huge infrastructure, there will have to be some type of catalyzing event for the public to recognize and realize the importance of what they're doing, so that they can justify these billions and billions of dollars of expenditures and these broad sweeping new powers. And of course, just as 9/11 served as the catalyzing event for all of the various changes to society that we've seen over the last 8 years, people have started to pump up the idea of a cyber 9/11 as some cyber war type event that's going to come along and change everyone's perception of the internet and how we should relate to it and what types of powers the government needs in order to justify this new cyber command, which you know, surprise, surprise, it's already been set up. It's already ready to go. Now all we need is the cyber war, the cyber 9/11 event, the catalyzing event. So I think you mentioned on your last episode that you don't think that this new North Korean attack is the cyber 9/11 event, and I don't think so either. I don't think this is going to be the event that justifies all of what's taking place right now. But
it's going to have to. I would think it's going to have to hit people in their Twitter. It's going to have to hit them in their Facebook, and that's what gives it that massive psychological effect.
Absolutely. I think you're exactly right. It's going to have to be something that does affect people on a more individual basis. But I think what we're seeing right now is the preparatory groundwork for that type of that psychological operation. People are now being told on all forms of media right now that this is a huge event. This is a major thing that just happened. It's probably cyber war. It might have come from North Korea, even though now we're finding out that it was coordinated through UK servers, which themselves were coordinated through VPN with servers in Florida. And threat level says that we have no idea where these were actually took place, and we have no way of tracing that. And so regardless of where it actually came from, the idea has been implanted. This was cyber war. It came from North Korea. We have to start changing the way we approach the internet. And so what we're seeing is the preparatory groundwork for this cyber 9/11. And again, that's not a phrase that I invented. This is a phrase that's being pumped out and through the media by the very people who are setting up this cyber war architecture, like the former NSA director, Mike McConnell, started using the term back in 2003, talking about cyber attacks that were going to have the equivalent effect of the attacks on the World Trade Center in New York. And you see cyber 9/11, I mean, just put that into Google and you'll find, you know, thousands of articles that have been written over the years of people talking about the threat to cybersecurity as a cyber 9/11. So now is the time when they're coming up with all of these reasons that we're going to have to start surrendering more and more of our online freedoms that we've taken for granted, like the idea of anonymity on the internet, however much that actually does exist, to whatever extent it exists, will obviously start to be eroded when we start putting in all of these new identity management systems in the wake of a new cyber 9/11. And of course, the key to understanding this is something that Lawrence Lessig, who is a Harvard professor of law, specifically dealing with internet law, last year at a technology conference in Half Moon Bay, California, he told the conference that he had been talking to Richard Clark, the former counterterrorism czar under Bush, and Richard Clark had told him that in the event of a cyber 9/11, of course, there is already an iPatriot Act written, ready to go, on the shelf. All it needs is this cyber 9/11, and they're going to introduce it and ram it through Congress, exactly as they did with the Patriot Act after 9/11. So we know that this is already ready to go, and there are sweeping changes to the internet that are coming. It's just going to take one of these attacks, whether it's an actual attack or a false flag attack, whether it's just something that's a completely made up media meme. No matter how it transpires, we're very likely to see some very large changes in the internet in the very near future, which is why we have to start attacking the fundamental premises of this whole cyberspace war and the way it's shaping up. And one way to do that is to point out that the real cyber 9/11 happened on 9/11. And that's really the key story, which just last week, a new break happened in this story. And the new break is an FBI indictment that was unsealed. Two indictments, one from 2007, one from 2005. And these indictments were unsealed last Wednesday, and they're extremely important. And I want your listeners to help me in getting the word out about this new indictment, because it is the key to unlocking a 15-year-old cyber terrorism story. It's been developing for the last 15 years. A major new break just happened last week. You're probably not going to hear about it on the nightly news, but it's the type of story that should be going mega viral right now, because it relates directly to 9/11 and cyber terrorism.
And so, the backstory. This all involves a software company known as P-TECH, and that's P-T-E-C-H. And again, as we say, we don't want to focus on the controlled demolitions. We want to look at what's going on behind the scenes. We can then look at the prior warnings, the insider trading, and all of just the things leading up to and facilitating the events of 9/11. So can you break down what P-TECH is and was?
All right. Well, to start getting into this story, we need to set the table by explaining something called enterprise architecture software. And basically, enterprise architecture software is a type of software that has a history to it, which again is fascinating and needs to be looked into. And I trust that your well-educated, well-informed audience can do that kind of research on their own by looking into things like PROMIS, P-R-O-M-I-S, which was, according to some researchers, the type of precursor to P-TECH software. But in a nutshell, enterprise architecture software is a type of software that will help someone visualize an organization or a structure, including all of the assets and the people in that structure and how they relate to each other. And so it has many applications. It's kind of vaguely defined there, but it could be used, for example, for something as mundane as business modeling. So you've got a very large enterprise, you have thousands, tens of thousands of workers in many different departments doing lots of different processes, working with lots of different systems. You want to find out how small changes in a certain process or maybe merging two departments is going to affect the organization as a whole. It will allow that type of modeling whereby you can tweak different parameters and come up with exactly how the organization is going to function after that point. And that's some of the mundane uses of this software. But by the 1990s, even the commercially available software, let alone whatever had been developed in cutting-edge research, but even the commercially available enterprise architecture software was starting to have really incredible functionality, to the point where it could be used to scan all of the data, all of the transactions, all of the things going on in an entire organization in real time, and thereby giving the opportunity for basic artificial intelligence type programming to be able to scan through that data to look for anomalous things. Now, that could again mean many different things in many different organizations, but if you take something like, for example, the New York Stock Exchange or some sort of major financial institution, obviously you could be looking for rogue trading, money laundering, suspicious trading activity, and you could flag that type of activity in real time. And the implication is that some of the people who were actually looking at using this software in the 1990s, at any rate, believed that this type of software could be used not only to find that type of suspicious activity as it's happening, but to be able to correlate and cross-correlate all of the data from that organization to actually predict that type of behavior. That in some way, this type of software could be used to predict or to take a look at trends and see where things might be occurring in the future. Now, obviously, this type of software would be valuable to any organization, but especially, of course, to extremely large organizations, and especially those running extremely sensitive or security-oriented type systems. So you're starting to think about organizations like the FBI, the Secret Service, the White House, the Navy, the Air Force, NATO, IBM, Booz Allen Hamilton, PricewaterhouseCoopers, Enron. All of these organizations in the 1990s were looking for this type of enterprise architecture software. And all of those ones that I just listed and many, many more turned to a company called P-TECH. P-TECH Inc., based in Quincy, Massachusetts. P-T-E-C-H, P-TECH. Now, P-TECH was founded in 1994 in Quincy, Massachusetts, by three men. There was Usama Ziad, James Serrato, and Ibrahim Hussein. Now, these three men founded this company based on $20 million of startup capital. And the $20 million of startup capital came from a number of investors, but the key investor who provided 25% of that, $5 million, was Yasin Al-Qadi. And Yasin Al-Qadi is a particularly interesting person because he, according to the U.S. government, is a global terrorist financier. And I can say that without being sued because the U.S. Department of Treasury actually says that, not me. The U.S. Department of Treasury, if you go to their website, you can find on October 12th, 2001, they issued a list of specially designated global terrorists. That is, in the wake of 9/11, they started to look for terrorist financiers, and they were finding people that they suspected, had reason to believe, were transferring money in the aim of pursuing international terrorism, and they listed them as specially designated global terrorists and froze all of their assets in the United States and encouraged all of the U.S. allies around the world to do the same. Yasin al-Qadi made that list on October 12th, 2001, and he was the founder... He was one of the founding investors in PTEC Inc. Now, again, this is significant because when you look at the clientele of PTEC, you've got FBI, you've got Secret Service, you've got the White House, you've got the FAA, you've got the Navy, the Air Force, you've got all of these extremely sensitive government systems that have this enterprise architecture software running on them. And this type of software, again, was developed specifically to give the user a kind of a god's eye view of an entire organization, including all of its access points, all of its weak points, all of the places where, for example, data might be being taken out. This would be absolutely visible to someone running the PTEC software. And now you have a specially designated global terrorist who is one of the key financiers of this particular company. So that's where the story starts to get interesting. Now, in order to flesh out the story, there are basically two people who were absolutely key in breaking this story and its significance wide open. And one of them was an FBI special agent named Robert Wright, and the other was a risk management consultant for J.P. Morgan called Indira Singh. Now, Robert Wright was an FBI special agent for the Chicago branch office of the FBI. And in the 1990s, he was running an investigation, an FBI investigation into terrorist financing. And this investigation was called Vulgar Betrayal. Vulgar Betrayal was on the tail of Yasin al-Qadi and some of the other organizations and charities and people in his general constellation. But Yasin al-Qadi was one of the specific people that was the target of this Vulgar Betrayal. And in fact, Vulgar Betrayal had even managed to seize $1.4 million of U.S. funds from that was sourced to Yasin al-Qadi through its investigation in the 1990s. Again, this is before 9/11, before all of that, this specially designated global terrorist designation came into existence. So even in the 1990s, Robert Wright was on the case of Yasin al-Qadi. And in 1998, shortly after the African embassy bombings, Vulgar Betrayal started to find a money trail linking the African embassy bombings to Yasin al-Qadi. Now, when he went to open a criminal investigation into al-Qadi and the links to the African embassy bombings, he went to his superior in order to get the clearance to start a criminal investigation. And his superior was, shall we say, not exactly happy with that. We have Robert Wright testifying that when he broached the idea of a criminal investigation into the connection between al-Qadi and the African embassy bombings, his superior flew into a rage, saying that you will not open such an investigation. There will be no criminal investigation into these intelligence assets. We are not going to have that. And within 1 year, Robert Wright was taken off of the Vulgar Betrayal investigation, and then the year after that, Vulgar Betrayal itself was shut down. So we have right there, we already start to see that there are people in places of key importance in these types of investigations that are trying to shut down any investigation into these links. Now, that's of course not the only place where you get that type of thing. The Vulgar Betrayal investigation was taken up after 9/11 by the U.S. Customs Office, which started up a new investigation into terrorist financing, which it called GreenQuest. And GreenQuest was run by the Customs Office, but it incorporated the FBI and many other investigative agencies in the U.S. government. But basically, according to one of the people working on Vulgar Betrayal, one of Robert Wright's associates, Operation GreenQuest was really just Vulgar Betrayal. They took the FBI's old case files and notes about Vulgar Betrayal and started using them in the post 9/11 terrorist financing investigation, which supposedly, well, that would be a good thing because we obviously want to come to an understanding of the money trail and how things are financed. Well, GreenQuest actually, of course, picked up on the PTEC link and started to notice that a specially designated global terrorist was, in fact, one of the financiers of PTEC, which had its software running on the back door of all these government agencies. So it started to investigate the links. And Operation GreenQuest actually raided PTEC's offices in late 2001. Late 2002, in December of 2002. Now, the same day that the offices were raided, Ari Fleischer, who was the White House press secretary at the time, said in an official White House press briefing that PTEC had been investigated, it had been looked over, the appropriate agencies had looked at the software and the code, there was no secret backdoor found, there was no security breach, it was all okay, it was all cleared. And then you start to see articles like the Mass High Tech Journal in 2003 had an article about PTEC. It was something along the lines of wrongly accused PTEC and CEO try to recover. And it's all this story about how PTEC had been wrongly accused, but completely vindicated and cleared because it had been raided and nothing suspicious had been found in the source code for the software. Therefore, it was all clear. What they blithely admit in about the eighth article of that Mass High Tech, the eighth paragraph of that Mass High Tech article, is that, in fact, the U.S. Customs had told PTEC weeks before that raid that they were going to be raided. So, again, what's the point of a raid that is well that you informed the subject of weeks in advance? Well, obviously, it's nothing. And also, the fact that they couldn't find anything at the source code at the PTEC office, does that actually mean that there was nothing suspicious about the particular implementation of PTEC running on these systems? Well, again, so it was a farce in itself, and ultimately there were no indictments and no charges that came from that GreenQuest raid. Okay, again, this is a mass investigation that came to nothing. But why is this important? Well, you have to look at PTEC and its specific links to what was happening on 9/11. As I mentioned, of course, already, the PTEC software was running on all of these very sensitive government agencies and presumably could have given someone with malicious intent and malicious desire the ability, the technological capability, to take a look at the back door of these systems and how people can get access to them and how people could, I suppose, potentially manipulate these systems. Well, why is that important? Well, another researcher, Indira Singh, who was a risk management consultant for JP Morgan Chase, was thinking of implementing PTEC software for the next generation of risk management software for JP Morgan back in 2002. And so she invited PTEC to their to her offices. But the demonstration that they were giving seemed a bit off to her. They wanted access to JP Morgan's actual network, even there at the demonstration, which of course violates all the protocols of this type of thing. Obviously, they weren't going to give them access to the JP Morgan network right there at the meeting. So red flags started to be raised about PTEC, and she started making calls to some of the people she knew who had recommended PTEC. And ultimately, she started to uncover some of these connections between PTEC and terrorist financing. And what she started to uncover was PTEC, of course, was not only operating in the FAA on 9/11, but PTEC was specifically looking into the interoperability between FAA systems and NORAD on 9/11. Now, of course, your listeners are probably by now well familiar with the complete stand down of NORAD on 9/11, which of course just boggles the mind how this multi-trillion dollar U.S. defense system was foiled four times on the same day without a single fighter interceptor taking down even one of these aircraft. again, the story just it begs to be investigated further. And what this indicates is that P-TECH was in fact actually running on the very systems that coordinated the FAA systems with NORAD systems on 9/11. So you start to have stories like at 9:24 a.m., one of the FAA operators contacted NORAD to inform NORAD that Flight 11 was in the air and heading towards Washington. But, of course, Flight 11 was one of the flights that hit the World Trade Center and, in fact, had been destroyed half an hour ago. Well, why did the FAA suddenly contact NORAD at 9:24 a.m. to tell them that Flight 11 was headed towards Washington? It has no basis in reality, and ultimately the 9/11 Commission itself concluded that they weren't able to track down the source of that information, and they just wrote it off as just another thing that happened on 9/11. Scratch your head. Well, who knows?
If I may interrupt quickly, and this is the part where we see all these initial declarations and bits of information that become the bedrock of the official story, that when we dig and tear down and we get to some of those main points, we don't know where that came from. We had P-TECH running on FAA and NORAD, so we know the confusion that was happening on the morning of 9/11, in addition to the drills, which I'm sure you were actually just about to get to. So please continue.
Well, that's exactly right. The other aspect of this are the drills that were running on that morning. Of course, we have Vigilant Guardian, which was an umbrella of drills and exercises that were going on in the Northeast Air Defense Sector and all over NORAD's radars that morning, that had things like, for example, hijacked jets flying into New York and blowing up. And it had other drills and exercises that were related of hijacked jets running into government buildings. So obviously we have, on the morning of 9/11, as Webster Tarpley said in one of his seminal speeches on the subject, you can't think of the morning of 9/11 as just another day of regular flight operations over the United States. You have to understand it as a morning of mass confusion, a forest of fake hijacked jets and fake blips on radar screens, and just mass confusion, which you start to get a glimpse of in things like, there is a famous Vanity Fair article about the NORAD tapes. And you start to get quotes like, I've never seen so much real-world activity during an exercise.
The drill started early today, or I think that's a damn input on my screen.
Exactly. So you have the evidence that there was some incredible confusion going on that morning. And obviously you have the implication that there were a number of fake hijacked aircraft that were being tracked and followed and were being confused with the actual hijacked aircraft that morning. And one of the possible ways in which that was carried out was through something like P-TECH software, which would have technologically had the capability to do things like insert those fake blips on the screens. Because one of the things that P-TECH would have had access to and would have been looking at on the morning of 9/11 would have been the type of software that the FAA and NORAD were using to carry out their fake military hijacking exercises, i.e. the software that was used to inject those fake blips onto the radar screens. Now, of course, the official story is that, once they figured out that this was a real-world thing, they just cleared out all those injects and there was no confusion. And I think the official line ultimately became that the exercises actually improved the response on the morning of 9/11, which is just something so, on its face, just so laughable, just so it would be laughable if it wasn't so disgusting.
And
if we weren't talking.
And I think we heard that from General Myers, at least in the, you know, of course, the fantastic clip of Cynthia McKinney questioning, grilling McKinney and Myers. And he ultimately says, I think it improved our abilities, which if that was an improvement,
I'd hate to see what they're really like. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So we have we have strong reason to believe that the P-TECH software, at least theoretically, could have given someone access to do this type of thing on the morning of 9/11. And we have not only Yasin al-Qadi, who was, of course, the founding investor in P-TECH, but other people involved with P-TECH who had ties to suspected international terrorist financing rings. You have, for example, two of the P-TECH employees were former members of something called CARE International. And this isn't the big, well-known CARE International. It's a smaller Muslim charity, which itself was suspected of terrorist financing and was raided by the U.S. government in terrorist financing raids. You have one of the architect of the P-TECH software was a guy who liked to write articles about in praise of Islamic holy war, and apparently was fond of quoting Abdullah Azzam, who of course was Osama bin Laden's mentor and the guy who founded Maktab al-Kidamat back in the 1980s in Afghanistan, which became Al-Qaeda. So, I mean, you have all of these different links that are going on with P-TECH and all of these terrorists, and then you have people that are stifling the investigations into those links. And Indira Singh, also the person that I mentioned earlier, who started to do a lot of the groundwork and the footwork on this case, she was doing all of this groundwork and footwork and collecting all this information. She even managed to get things like the P-TECH's business plan for their work with the FAA, which actually showed from P-TECH's own documents that they had access to the FAA's network management, network security, help desk operations. I mean, everything that you could think of that would be of importance to someone who wanted to gain access to the FAA's systems, they had access to. So she uncovered all of this incredible information. She did a lot of the groundwork and the legwork on this case and started to get it out to mainstream outlets. There was an investigative team on Boston Channel. I think it was a CBS channel, I'm not sure, that was covering this story in late 2002. And she was, of course, trying to bring this story to the attention of the FBI in Boston so that they would open their own investigation into this. And she was told by one of the FBI agents that she was in contact with that, Indira Singh, you are more capable of doing research on this story outside of the FBI than we are inside. Now, obviously, this indicates that there are people in key places that have been suppressing this investigation into P-TECH and into its links to terrorist financing. And the implication of that is that, of course, you can take a look at the P-TECH story and say, oh, okay, so Al-Qaeda-type people have infiltrated the inner sanctum of the U.S. government, and that helped them to carry out 9/11. Well, if that were so, then why are well-placed people in positions of power to shut down investigations shutting down the investigation into P-TECH? Are they also Al-Qaeda, or is there more Al-Qaeda to this? And another indication of that is the Operation GreenQuest, which I mentioned earlier, which was sort of the continuation of Operation Vulgar Betrayal, which was Robert Wright's investigation, was itself shut down. It became embroiled in a turf war. It was, of course, being run by the Customs Department. It became embroiled in a turf war with the FBI, which wanted to gain control over the investigation. And we've already seen how the FBI has investigated these terrorist financing links. And ultimately, it gets shut down. And who was the one responsible for that? Just happens to be Michael Chertoff. And what does he get promoted to? Oh, head of Homeland Security. So again, time after time after time, in every way it can, this investigation has been stifled and thwarted. And it's important to keep in mind that, again, there are real agents on the inside that are truly working to expose this type of thing, like Robert Wright. But there are people that are stopping them from doing it. Which brings us back to the indictment that just was released last week on Wednesday, July 15th, by the Boston FBI. Now, this indictment, as I say, it's from 2005 and 2007. It was just unsealed last week. And the indictment is specifically against two individuals. Usama Ziad, who you'll remember is one of the founders of P-TECH and was the CEO at the time of 9/11. And a man by the name of Buford George Peterson. He was the CFO and the COO of P-TECH at the time of 9/11. So the indictment specifically alleges that the FBI has information that leads them to believe that Ziad and Peterson were lying in a loan application that they made in the wake of 9/11. Now, get this. Ironically enough, in the wake of 9/11, the government, by executive order, started a program to provide business loans to businesses whose business was threatened or was adversely affected by 9/11. So, of course, PTEC decides to apply for such a loan. Well, how were they adversely affected by 9/11? Well, could it be because suddenly they were in the news as being associated with specially designated global terrorists? But anyway, so they apply for one of these loans. And on the loan documentation, they have to, of course, disclose who the investors in the company are. Even though it's a private company, they're applying for government funding. So they have to disclose the investors and how much they've invested in the company. Now, the FBI, in this new indictment that was just unsealed last week, is alleging that they specifically lied to the FBI. They lied on the loan application by trying to cover up the extent of the involvement of Yasin al-Qadi, the specially designated global terrorist, with PTEC, even after 9/11, even after he was put on the specially designated global terrorist list. And basically, the FBI is saying that the internal documents they've uncovered show that Usama Ziad and others had privately written down that through various investment vehicles, Qadi had $9.9 or $10 million invested in the company. They were trying to say that after his initial investment, he had nothing to do with the company. So again, the FBI is alleging that they lied on that documentation. And it's also saying that the other indictment from 2005 is saying that Usama Ziad had actually been caught, according to the FBI. They have reason to believe that he was transferring some of al-Qadi's assets for him through various fronts and vehicles after he was declared a specially designated global terrorist, which, of course, is illegal. So, again, the FBI in Boston has just unsealed these documents, and Peterson was taken in at JFK Airport last week, which I guess is why the indictments have been unsealed. So right now, we're starting to see the beginning of what could be the first crack in this case. And of course, it's not going to be a crack in the case. It's not going to amount to anything, and the word's not going to get out about it unless we get the word out about this. So that's why I'm calling on your listeners, your well-researched and incredible listeners, to help get the word out about this new FBI indictment and why it's so important.
And it's difficult in a way because this doesn't have the fireworks that get people's attention of buildings exploding. This is somewhat more mundane aspects of things that I think sometimes fail to capture, you know, the inquisitive nature, or capture the imagination, if you will, of people trying to investigate this.
You're right. You're right. Absolutely. I think we have to understand that this is an information war, that we really do have to get the information out to people in a way that they'll be drawn into the story. Because once you're into the story, of course, you can see there's a lot to be investigated, and it's an incredible story. It's a mind-blowing story. But again, what is the handle that will get people interested in it? And the approach that I took in my article is that right now we're hearing about the cyber 9/11. We're hearing about cyber terrorism. Well, my point is, hey, look, here's a cyber terrorism story for you. And so I'm trying to use that angle to get people's attention. Again, I'm sure there are 100 other angles or different ways to present this, but whatever it is, I just hope that people will help me to get the word out about this.
I was going to say, I'm familiar with some of these things as far as the Green Quest raids. I know from the work of Dave Emery of For the Record and WFMU.org. He's done a lot of work on that. And even the story of Indira Singh, who we mentioned as being the risk management worker for JP Morgan, which is no small potatoes there. It reminds me of the story of Richard Andrew Grove, the guy behind 9/11 Synchronicity and Eighth Estate, and now his new Tragedy and Hope. His story was he was working on software for Marsha McLennan that would be a new AI type of software, and he saw in the months leading up to 9/11 strange financial transactions and seeming payoffs and money laundering and things. When he brought it to his superiors, they essentially, long story short, fired him.
Absolutely. And you'll remember one of the points of that story was that he was actually on his way to the World Trade Center for a meeting on the 100-and-something floor of people involved with that IT infrastructure and things that he had had access to. And he was supposed to be in that meeting when the plane hit. And all of course, the people that were in that meeting ended up dying. And that's part of Indira Singh's story as well. She was on her way to a meeting in the World Trade Center on the 106th floor or whatever it was, that was related to the work that she was doing in this IT software. That, and so I'm not sure, I don't know, and I'm not going to make the assumption, but I don't know if that's the same meeting, but certainly these stories are, shall we say, highly congruent.
Absolutely. And again, as you do the work and you dig through these things, you do start to see the connections. I think your article is a great summation. It's an easy read if you're unfamiliar with these topics. You don't have to be well versed in all of this to get the article and see it in and read it in one sitting. There's great links in there. So you linked everything from .gov websites to, you know, the original, you know, Boston Herald reports of things. And we, of course, I think should mention historycommons.org and their, you know, invaluable complete 9/11 timeline. I think the thing that's so great about it in a way is that it doesn't draw any conclusions for you. It just says, here, the 9/11 Commission said this. Here, New York Times said this, but these other FBI agents said that.
Absolutely, yes. I can't stress that enough. In fact, a lot of the research came from historycommons.org, and if there's one place that people go to check out the story, I would recommend that they go there and just type PTEC into the historycommons.org search engine and start to follow the links, because of course they do provide the links to all of the original source material for all of this incredible information. So absolutely, 100%, I agree, historycommons.org is a great place to start with this story and many others.
And we'll also note, and again, we'll try and in my show notes for this interview put up all the pertinent links and things, but to also a previous and older episode of the Corbett Report, which was episode 45, PTEC and the 9/11 software. So how long ago was this episode? And this, I imagine, set you up so when you saw that this new indictment was unsealed, it maybe perhaps gave you an aha.
That's a good question. I don't recall off the top of my head exactly when that was. It must have been probably around middle of 2008 or so. And, of course, I had a bit of Indira Singh's testimony in my episode 31, which was Welcome to 9/11 Truth, which came out in early 2008. So definitely I've had my eye on this story for a couple of years now. And but I don't want to take any credit for this. I mean, obviously, there's so many researchers out there that have put in so much blood, sweat and tears into this research. And of course, now you have people like Indira Singh who have had their life threatened because of this type of research. So absolutely everyone has to support these researchers by doing their own bit to get the word out about this incredible information that they have literally risked their life to bring to you.
It's amazing that we preface all this with the recent cyber attacks. And it, in a way, so much of this new kind of era has been ushered in by the Obama era. So much of now it's NASA and the moon again, and a lot of sort of cyber updates. And of course, now we need the cybercom. It all seemed so well timed that with our new president, we're going to usher in these new ideas and these new memes and these new preparatory moves.
I don't like to bring in the specter of psych warfare operations when I don't have any proof for it. But certainly if there's any time I've ever seen sort of psych warfare media softening up going on, it's been for this cyberspace war, specifically with this presidency. Because, of course, part of the whole Obama phenomenon, which happened last year, part of it was, oh, this is going to be the cyber presidency. He's going to be, you know, on YouTube and using, you know, whatever, Twitter or whatever he gets into next. And that's been a part of the Obama propaganda since the 2008 run-up. And also, one of the documents that I've cited in my previous article, Worldwide Wiretap, was a CSIS. I can't remember what that stands for, Center for Studies in International something or other, which, of course, one of the chairs of that is Zbigniew Brzezinski. So this is a high-level think tank. And back in 2007, I believe, they started in a year-long blue ribbon panel to come up with a report that was specifically recommendations for the 44th presidency, and it was all about the cybersecurity issue and angle. So definitely high-level think tanks have been thinking about framing this 44th presidency as the cyber presidency since before, you know, Obama was even elected.
So I wanted to double check on what that was because I thought it might be. So I went to CSIS.org, and they are the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
That's it. Thank you.
So there we go.
Not to be confused with the Canadian Security Intelligence Service, which is also an interesting organization which people should be looking into.
All the alphabets. The other alphabet that I brought up, of course, was CAIR, which in this case here, we were talking about CAIR, the Council on American Islamic Relations. So those are just a couple of things I brought up as we were.
I'm not 100% sure about that. Every time I've seen it written in all of the research that I've done, it was CARE. I think it might even be the exact same name as the well-known organization. It might be that one. I'm not sure. I just don't want to confuse anyone out there. You're already confused. This is very confusing. But please, the point is to start getting into the research for yourself and starting to come to these things, understanding on your own, because until you internalize this information, there's no way you can make sense of it. And I'll be the first to admit that the first time I listened to, for example, Indira Singh's conversations on the subject, it was just a mass of information, and I had a hard time really putting the pieces together and connecting the dots. But in doing things like putting together the podcast and writing the articles, I've come to my own understanding and started to connect some of the dots in my head. So it's really important that people try to put this type of information together for themselves so that they're able to actually start to gain the picture. And again, please don't take my word for it. Do the research for yourself and start to come to your own understanding.
Absolutely. I think, you know, if people spent as much time knowing about the RBIs of their favorite baseball player or who got voted off, whatever reality show, this is the real reality. And these are the things that, again, when we're talking about some of the intricacies of this story, it sounds like a movie. And there's that disconnect where you can see those things in the movies, but that's just made-up movie stuff. That would never happen in real life. There would never be, you know, moles and triple agents and people calling and warning people about raids, whether it's, you know, in The Departed or, God, you know, we see it all the time. But when it happens in our face, we slough it off and say, no, they're all just incompetent.
I was actually thinking about that when I was putting this article together, and I was thinking that some people had said that this sounds like a Tom Clancy novel or something, except it's real. But I think even if it was in a Tom Clancy novel or whatever, I think people would have a hard time accepting it. They'd go, oh, that's just ridiculous. That couldn't happen. Having a specially designated global terrorist financing an organization that's creating software that has backdoor access to the FAA on 9/11. Oh, that's just ridiculous. That could never happen. I mean, it's almost cartoon. It's like something you'd find in a comic book version of reality, and yet it is real.
And I think there you actually just summed it up. You know, how would a specially designated terrorist run a software company that was in the back door of FAA and NORAD on the morning of 9/11? There it is.
There you go. If you have to sum it up in one sentence, let's use that, and let's get the word out to other people about this.
Brother, thanks for taking the time. I really appreciate it. Are there any other last words that you want to send out?
I think that's it for me. I just want to tell you to keep doing the work you're doing. I know how hard and grueling it can be to put together a show like that every week. And so I'm, again, my hat's off to you. And I want to let everyone know that I am going to be on hiatus for the next few weeks at CorbettReport.com. But I am coming back, and I still have the info bomb that I'm still going to be dropping, hopefully this fall. So keep tuned to that, to CorbettReport.com, for more about that.
All right, man. Fantastic. And of course, we'll also mention AlQaedaDoesn'tExist.com. There's so much out there on CorbettReport.com. Articles, interviews, videos. It's a great resource. And again, I thank you.
Thank you, sir. And take care.
All right.
Scotland Yard, Interpol and Deutsche Bank, FBI and Scotland Yard.
How would you explain it?
Combining music and stylized images.
It's all remote control.
Each one of those images was electronically based.
Say out on my threat.
And that concludes our program for tonight.
This could really catch on.
I can't remember when I've been so moved.